Evan, and his product insight, his understanding of the consumer has led to building a product that started at 50% DMAU and then went to 60 and 70 and just keeps on going up because he understands the user. So it's not about like a clever growth hack. It's about understanding the user and what they want.
Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. So that was Jeremy Liu. He's a partner at Lightspeed, and he's the VC who made the first investment into Snapchat. We're talking back in 2012, so over 10 years ago, when the company was valued at just shy of $5 million. So when he invested, Lightspeed got 10% of the company for just under $500K. And so you'll hear from him later about what it was that he saw in Evan and in Snapchat back then and why he thinks that Snapchat had the success that it had. But before we start, I'll just mention that, you know, most of what you hear on today's episode is from my own research into a bunch of different sources, including the book on Snapchat, How to Turn Down $1 billion, several kind of Snapchat podcasts and interviews like Acquired and OMR and other online research. And just to set context, I mean, today Snapchat is a $18 billion company. They're doing just shy of $5 billion in revenue. They have 800 million monthly active users, 400 million daily active users. And it's funny, like I always talk about how you don't want to start a startup with this, like, wouldn't it be cool if mindset, because if you start with that, you tend to be led pretty astray. And this is a total exception. I mean, if you look at how this started, it's not even Evan, by the way. Evan Spiegel, he's the CEO. He's one of the founders of Snapchat. He didn't have the idea. It was his like frat bro. It was Reggie Brown. He's like, hey, these guys are, they're like 21 years old. They're at Stanford in frat house. They're, you know, hanging out, throwing parties every few days. I mean, they're doing the classic things that you would expect happen in a frat house when you're 20, 21 years old. And Reggie one day is like sending pictures to some girl he knows. And he just literally has this like aha moment, like completely textbook classic case of wouldn't it be cool if. And he just goes to Evan and he's like, dude, wouldn't it be cool if I sent somebody a picture and it just like automatically disappeared. Evan loves it. Evan just loves that idea and he jumps on it. That, believe it or not, is how an $18 billion company is born. To understand how it all really played out, you got to understand kind of some of the context. Because today, I mean, we're 2024. It's harder to remember what the world was like back in 2010, 2011. So just some facts to throw at you. I mean, today there's 1.5 billion iPhone users. That's how popular the iPhone is. And obviously, there's more Android users than that. So there are billions and billions of mobile phone users in the world. But the iPhone started in 2007. The App Store didn't launch till 2008. And by 2011, which is when Snapchat gets created, there's only 150 million total iPhones that have been sold. So the market is about 10% what it is today. And this is really like the age of mobile. If you look at the period from 2008 to 2012, that is when all of the $10 billion plus mobile first companies were created. Uber, Lyft, Postmates, Spotify, Venmo, WhatsApp, they all were created during that time. But they were still like in their infancy in 2011. Think about WhatsApp, which is probably the best comparable to Snapchat because it's another one of these messaging applications. WhatsApp had 10 million users in 2010. By 2011, it had 50 million users. To give you a comparable, in 2011, when WhatsApp had 50 million users, BlackBerry BBM, if you remember, BlackBerry Messenger, which was like the hottest thing back then, had 60 million users. So BlackBerry Messenger in 2011 is more popular than WhatsApp. This is the world that Evan's living in. We're talking about people who had like flip phones for most of their lives. Even at this point, like in 2011, only a third of teens have a smartphone and about two-thirds of college students have smartphones. So even in college where they're at, there's a third of their friends that don't have one. I mean, that's unimaginable today, but this is the world they were living in. And so it's in this context that this idea of like a disappearing image comes to Reggie. And this is a huge reason why things played out, as you'll see, the way that they did. There is this tailwind. There is this like undercurrent, this tailwind that, to be clear, they did not identify. And this, I think, is very, and I go on these tangents because I think at the end of the day, we're not just telling stories for the sake of it. We're telling stories so we can understand what it takes to get product market fit and hopefully build a massive company. And you can see very clearly, neither Evan nor Reggie nor the other co-founder, the technical co-founder that comes in later, Bobby, they don't have a thesis about mobile. They haven't really thought through strategically what's happening now that the app store is out, now that these mobile apps are coming out. They end up landing on it and they end up benefiting from this tailwind. And this is super common. I'm not taking anything away from Evan. I'm saying that actually this is the way things typically work out. Now, Evan, he's a designer. Like he's a product designer type. He actually can't code. So the first thing he does, going back to when Reggie kind of pops into his room and says, hey, disappearing images, as he starts thinking through this idea and kind of really buys into it, he gets his friend, Bobby Murphy, who's a couple years older, is 23 years old. He just graduated. At this point, to be clear, Evan and Reggie, they're sophomores. They're in their second year. And so Evan's friend, Bobby, he's just graduated. He has a full-time job now. And the reason that he goes to Bobby is because actually Evan and Bobby had previously worked together on another startup. This is another thing that I find so interesting about this story is that, like, in a way, Evan did everything wrong. They worked out tremendously well. But, you know, we talk about you don't want to start a startup with wouldn't it be cool if. You also don't want to start a startup by forcing it. Like, the last thing you want as a founder is to be like, I just want to start a startup. I just want to be a founder. And you're just chasing ideas. I did that. I did that at Gymtrack. And I can tell you, it's so likely that you come up with an idea that sounds good on paper, but doesn't work in reality. The best way to actually uncover great ideas is to just get interested in spaces and solve problems almost for the sake of it. And you end up uncovering more interesting problems most of the time that way. But this was not the case. And so Evan and Bobby had worked together on previous kind of startup ideas before because they so desperately wanted to be founders. And one of these was Future Freshmen. The idea with Future Freshmen was kind of informed by what, you know, Evan and Bobby had lived through. I mean, they were students at the time. They're like 20 years old. They've only really been students their whole life. They haven't had a job yet. And so their whole kind of idea of the world is framed by that. And one of the problems that they encounter was, hey, look, when you're applying to university, when you're like looking for universities to apply to, like it's a mess. You have to click through all these websites. You have to go through all these places to just understand what the programs are, where you might be a fit, where you might not be a fit. So they built out Future Freshmen, which was this website, this kind of portal, let's say, that you could go into. You could figure out kind of which college you should go to, which university you should go to. And they wanted to sell it actually to schools. They wanted to sell it to like advisors at high schools and these sort of things. And they worked on it for like over a year. They actually, funny enough, got their like pledges from their fraternity to work on it, obviously for free. I mean, Evan talks about this a lot. Like it just didn't work for a variety of reasons. But I think one of the main reasons is they really weren't building for themselves. Like they really didn't understand the problem set all that well. Like they were informed by their own opinions, but the reality is, like, he even said he had like his younger sister and Bobby's younger brother, neither of them used it because, like, the honest truth is most high school students, like, they just don't care that much. And even if they use the platform, they're certainly not going to pay for it. So now you got to go sell to schools. These guys have no idea how to sell to schools. They don't actually understand, and neither do they do the research to figure out, like, what the problem looks like for the counselors, for the advisors that are in the high schools. So this project totally doesn't work, but they obviously enjoyed working together. So this is the first person that Evan goes to work on Snapchat. And Bobby ends up playing like a critical role because turns out that Reggie, even though he had like the first idea, I mean, the idea of disappearing pictures, he, beyond that, really didn't play much of a role. I mean, initially, there were three co-founders, right? Reggie, Evan, and Bobby. But even in the very early days, Evan and Bobby start really doing kind of all of the work. Reggie ends up kind of like leaving the company or getting kicked out of the company, depending on who you ask. I mean, there's a whole lawsuit about this that we won't get into here. But the bottom line is that the key people at the beginning were really Bobby and Evan. And I mean, Evan spent most of his time kind of on vision and design, and Bobby was the key person on product and tech and ultimately like build the team that really scaled and pioneered a lot of the kind of computer vision, the lenses, the AR stuff that ended up making Snapchat what it is today. So they get to working, and their first idea is actually not to build an app, but to build a website. Why is that? Today, it seems so weird. Back then, in 2011, that's where you went first. The age of mobile was really just coming up. And if you recall, this is about the time where actually Facebook was making the transition from web to mobile. So this is where they start off. They build this like web app sort of thing. They call it Peekaboo, by the way. It wasn't called Snapchat back then. It was called Peekaboo. That was the first name. And they work on it through summer 2011 while they're on summer break. And they launch it and it just falls flat, like totally flat. They get zero downloads on day one. They keep pushing and pushing. It's funny. Like Evan talks about, he goes to the mall. Like he actually goes to the mall to convince people to join this platform. They do at some point end up launching a mobile app. But even still, by August, September, we're talking like 5 months in, you know, 5-6 months in after the original idea happens, they have only 127 users. It's certainly not flying off the shelves by any means. And this is a consumer app. I mean, you need tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of users before this gets interesting at all. And so Evan, kind of like with his tail between his legs, so to speak, has to go back to school. He wanted to drop out. He wanted to be a founder, but the thing just wasn't hitting. Now, in the meantime, and to their credit, what they are doing is they're making it as simple to use as possible. And this is something that I thought was a huge reason why it ultimately took off, which is when you opened up the app, it was instantly on camera. And if you remember back in these days, like 2010, 2011, when you opened up the camera on your actual iPhone, like you went to the camera app, it had this like weird animation. It was like the camera lens like opening up. That added about a second. And they actually kind of hacked. They hacked the software to be able to get rid of that animation so that loading up Snapchat's camera was faster than loading up the iPhone camera. They're doing all these little design tweaks, product tweaks to make the product easier and easier to use. But the reality is that for the average college student, there just isn't enough here. Like, it's kind of this cool idea and people knew Evan, so they tried it out, but they've got BBM, they've got WhatsApp, they've got texting, they've got all these other ways to communicate with their friends. And of course, they've got Instagram and they've got Facebook. So they've got all these other social media apps. There's just no like, hair on fire reason to start using Snapchat, which is why Snapchat ended up taking off with an entirely different set of users. It wasn't 20-year-olds. They were effectively too old. It was actually high school students. And it's pretty insane the way that this works out. It turns out that Evan's mom tells her niece, so this is Evan's cousin, who's a high school student, about the app. And her niece in Orange County starts using it with her friends during school. Evan didn't know any of this. So he's looking at his dashboards and at some point in like September, October-ish of 2011, starts to see these spikes between 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. And this is his cousin, it turns out, with her friends using it in high school. So then the big question, the obvious question is, why did it take off there? And we've talked about another concept before, which is kind of find the weak spot. When you're putting out something new into market, you've got to find the angle, the spot where competition is extremely, extremely weak. Talk about David and Goliath. So you are very much David versus the Goliaths. At that point, the Goliaths are BBM, their WhatsApp, their Instagram, their Facebook for sure. They're much, much bigger than Snapchat was. And in the places where those apps are already used, already popular, it's really hard to penetrate. But what's going on? What's going on is that when Evan's cousin is in school, first of all, phones are not allowed. And like I said before, only a third of teens had smartphones. So most people don't have smartphones. So phones, of course, not allowed in class. iPads, though, those were allowed. But the iPads are provided by the school and popular apps like Facebook are blocked out. WhatsApp, to be clear, you need a phone number associated. So that doesn't work either. So they actually have no good means to communicate with each other. And that is where Snapchat fills a clear void. That's how it comes in, because the hardest thing is to get you to download something and to just start using it. Once they get used to Snapchat, now we're in a totally different world, because now what they start to realize is, wow, this app is so much better to communicate. And these are people that have not been used to texting. They haven't been used to any other world because this world didn't exist yet. So all of a sudden, they have this really rich communication platform through images, images plus text. Remember, that was another feature they added in, which wasn't just the idea of disappearing pictures. It was a picture with some text that you could add. And so this is how these teens start talking to each other. And of course, they take it outside of the class as well. And there are a few other things that really matter too. Evan talks in the early days about how he has this thesis, and Jeremy Liu, you'll hear about him talking about it later, about how, you know, everything on Facebook, everything on Instagram is by default there forever. And that doesn't really make sense. I mean, most conversations are ephemeral. As soon as you have a conversation with someone in real life, it kind of goes away. It's not recorded. And it'd be weird if it was recorded. And he talks about that being an underlying reason why Snapchat took off. But I think at the end of the day, if you think about a teen, like they're not that forward-looking. I think at the end of the day, what Snapchat became is a really compelling way at first to like talk during class, which is a thing that teens have been doing in classes forever. You write like a little note on paper, you pass it on, like that was never going to stop. And this was just a much better way of doing that. Of course, the fact that it disappeared also meant, guess what? You can't get caught, right? The teacher can't actually grab the piece of paper and read in front of everybody. By the time the teacher notices, the picture's gone. Now when these high school students go back home and they do have a phone they can use or an iPad, guess what? The parents also can't see what they're talking to their friends about. So this is like a no-brainer better way of communicating with your friends. And once you've gotten used to it and you've tried it out, there's just no reason to stop and there's no reason to go to anything else. And there's all the reason to tell your friends about it. And this is what starts to take it off. It turns out that none of the marketing mechanics that Evan tried, including, like I said, the hand-to-hand combat of going to malls, but every single thing that he did didn't work. The only thing that worked was ultimately finding a weak spot, which he stumbled upon, but it doesn't really matter. That's what ended up happening. And then word of mouth. And once that happened, things just took off. The numbers are staggering. In August, he has 127 users. By December of that year, he has 2,000 users. January, 20,000 users. And by April of 2012, he's up to 100,000 daily active users. This is the power of finding a market that is very underserved and having an experience that's natively viral, not in the way that like Zoom or Hotmail is viral, where you send it to somebody who doesn't have it and they're exposed to it. And this is where like the power of network effects really play out. Because of course, once you're exposed to it, you're so likely to tell your best friends about it because you want them to have it so you can talk to them on iPads or iPhones or Android phones, and in a way that nobody else can see the images. And then they tell their friends, and then they tell their friends. And this is what drove growth. The other thing that's important to remember is even texting back then was, texting images was quite slow. Like it took a lot of time to upload and it was very expensive. So that was another piece that also made Snapchat so compelling. And Evan on the OMR podcast actually mentioned specifically how disappearing photos wasn't actually the reason why it took off.
Is that people weren't really using it to send photos that disappeared. They didn't care that much about that part. What they were really focused on was talking with pictures, because it became a much more expressive way to show your friends what you were doing or how you feel. You know, text messaging can be very boring. It's hard to understand sometimes. But when you send a photo, you can show your emotion in a split second. And so I think people really enjoyed talking visually. And so we renamed the app Snapchat. And you know, that was in 2011. And I guess the rest is history.
And so clearly at this point, Snapchat is starting to have some success. And from talking to Jeremy, like what the data showed was that it was all organic, right? It was really the right product at the right time. And it went viral through word of mouth. And Jeremy explains how you could clearly see that in the data.
There is a good amount of luck involved in social software. It's not just about the right product and the right features. It's about resonating to the right users at the right time to create a culture that wants to propagate itself. When that happens, when you know, the lightning strikes, it really can propagate. So that was one of the things that we saw, is we looked at the growth over time. And, you know, there was only a few months of data, but what you could see is that it was highly geographic. You know, it was growing in LA. There was a little segment in Georgia that had just started to grow, but it was growing at the same rate. What that told you is that this was genuine word of mouth. People were telling people nearby who were then using it with each other. And you continue to see that over time, you know, not just in those first few months, but, you know, somehow it picked up a little following in Sweden, and it started to grow in Scandinavia, but it hadn't picked up in the UK yet. And eventually, Saudi Arabia became a big local growth opportunity. But because all this growth was happening through genuine word of mouth, these geographic hotspots were like evidence that this is real, not manufactured virality, not invitation-driven virality, virality driven by people like sharing it with the people that were right by them, right close by, going to school with them, their friends.
You know, with all this success, I mean, people sending more and more images, and Evan is not making any revenue. And so literally the server costs started to go up to a point where can't afford it. I mean, he put in like $10,000 into this business. Bobby had put in a little bit of money, and his dad was funding it as well. But his dad was like, I'm not going to keep money into a business that earns no revenue so people can just send like pictures to each other. And so Evan starts to think about fundraising, and he talks to Sequoia. He goes after Chris Sacca. He meets many different VCs. All of them pass. Some of them won't even like meet with him. And as this is happening, though, Barry Eggers, who is a partner at Lightspeed, sees his daughter using Snapchat, and he tells Jeremy Liu about it. And that's how Jeremy Liu and Lightspeed end up getting involved. And so I asked Jeremy to share the entire story with us.
My partner, Barry Eggers, you know, the reason we got into Snapchat, or we heard about Snapchat, is because Barry is an engaged dad. He noticed that his daughter, who was in high school at the time, had changed the way that she was taking selfies. You know, historically, she took selfies trying to look pretty. He noticed that she'd started taking selfies, making weird faces, or, you know, with only half of her face in the frame, just like very different from the, you know, look pretty with a pretty background. So he asked her, like, what's going on? Why are you making these weird faces when you take photos? And she said, oh, Dad, it's this new app called Snapchat. It's like everybody's using it at school. there's like three apps that everybody has on their phone at school: Instagram, Angry Birds, because this was 2011, and Snapchat. You know, at the time, it was like, huh, interesting. Instagram's pretty big. Angry Birds is pretty big, but I haven't heard the Snapchat thing. And so he mentioned it to me and put it on my radar. And so that's how we, you know, first heard about the company.
And how did you go from there to actually meeting Evan?
Well, so the thing is, you know, Snap is social software. And so you don't really fully experience using the product unless you're using it with other people, and ideally, you know, people who have been natively using it. So to download the product without that context, I didn't, you know, at the time it was primarily used by, you know, high school students, and I didn't know any high school students. So I downloaded it, I looked at it, and I was like, eh, don't really get it. And so I didn't really take a lot of action on it, but, you know, again, credit to Barry. He was pretty, like, he kept on my, he's like, hey, like, did you find out more about the Snapchat thing? I think it really could be pretty interesting. You know, my daughter and all her friends, they're using it all the time. They're talking about it. I'm like, okay, I'll check it out. And so obviously the first thing you do is you go to the website, and, you know, the website at the time was just a single page, you know, with the logo and an info@snapchat.com email address. So I emailed it, and I never heard anything back. And so like later on, he's like, hey, Jim, he's like, oh yeah, I'm working on that. I'm going to find out more about it. Like, so it's like, well, okay, what do I do? Let me look it up on LinkedIn. And, you know, it turns out that Snapchat had one employee, CEO and founder and sophomore at Stanford, Evan Spiegel. I was like, great. Okay. So, I messaged him through LinkedIn, and I never heard anything back. And I was like, okay. Well, you know, let me think about what I can do. I did a Whois lookup. I saw that the URL was registered to info@Tapoya Group. It's like, great. So I emailed that, and I never heard anything back. I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is becoming like a challenge. How am I going to figure out how to get in touch with this guy? So I basically started spamming every variation. Evan@snapchat.com, E_Spiegel@ToyopaGroup.com, Spiegel_Evan@Snap, like every variation of just shooting emails out into the void. And I never heard anything back. Barry was like constantly like, hey, any like get in touch with this Snapchat guys. I really think it could be interesting. I'm like, I'm on it. And finally, I was like, I don't know what to do. But I noticed that, you know, Evan was a student at Stanford. And I graduated from Stanford from the business school. And so back then you could DM anyone on Facebook if you were within the same network. And so I DM'd him, and I got a message back in like 2 minutes. You know, I was like, hey, I'm hearing great things about, you know, Snapchat, like from folks, like, I'd love to hear more about it. He's like, sure, you know, like, happy to tell you about it. I'm like, great. Like, I'm just down the road. We set up a meeting for maybe a day or two later, and he came over and, you know, told us the story, cracked open his analytics. You know, he said, look, you know, things are going great, but like, you know, I'm starting to max out the credit cards. You know, we're growing so fast that like, I can't afford my server bills. And I was like, well, maybe we can help you with that. And so that's how we came to invest.
That's quite an epic story. Do you know now, like, I think back to that time, you know, and as Evan then admitted, like, he really needed money. So do you know why he didn't respond to those first requests? Was he just not checking? Did you ever find that out? I'm just curious.
I think that's largely what it was. You know, like, if you think about, like, what are the native modalities that you check all the time, you know, especially in college, you know, when you're in your, like, you're 19, 20, something like that. It's definitely not LinkedIn.
Right.
You know, it's barely email. It's, you know, messaging and, you know, and social. So it's mostly messaging. That's where you spend your time. And, you know, I remember one time, cause I had donated to the Obama campaign, and I was trying to show off. So I was like, I'd put my, changed my profile picture to this photo of me shaking hands with Obama. And, he said, like, yeah, the reason that I responded to your Facebook message was that I saw that your profile picture was with you and Obama, and I figured you must be a halfway decent human being.
That's good. So it worked.
Best political donation I ever made.
That's right. Incredible ROI.
I know, right?
The other thing I'd read, so maybe now that, because you're meeting with Evan at this point, how was that meeting? How quickly did you decide that, you know what, because at that point you weren't actually fully bought in, right? So like you have this meeting.
Not only was I not fully bought in, I just didn't understand it because, you know, I couldn't natively use the product the way that it was being used. So first of all, he did a couple of things. He just told me some of the metrics and then he cracked open his analytics dashboard and he showed me. And, you know, what I saw was 50% daily active user to monthly active user ratio. I saw 50% D30 retention. Extraordinary. And I saw 50% month-on-month growth on a statistically significant number of users. I can't remember exactly what it was. It was 10 or 20,000 DAUs. And that had been persistent over time. So it sort of didn't matter whether I got it or not. The data was very clear that this was resonating. But then he explained it. And so that's the other important. Today, everybody understands, you know, principles behind Snapchat and how a lot of social media creates this performance anxiety, which means that you don't post. And so like you get this sort of more of a social media perspective with a small number of posters, large number of consumers. And he talked about how the, you know, the disappearing messages really reduced performance anxiety because there wasn't going to be persistence. So you could put something that didn't look perfect. And that was consistent with the behavior that I heard that people were sending these photos where they were deliberately trying to look weird or funny or ugly, making faces and so forth. And the context was less about the photo. It was the sub message, which is, hey, I'm thinking about you. You're my friend. I'm thinking about you. I want to make you laugh. You know, he went on to explain in a really kind of clear way that, I mean, he made this example. It's like, hey, if you're with your friend and you're catching up and you're talking, like, haven't seen each other in a while. And then at the end of the conversation, he says, oh, by the way, I recorded all of this. Wait, what? Like, what do you mean you record? It's like, yeah, I just recorded. Is that okay? It's like, no, it's not okay. Because historically, when humans had conversations, nothing was recorded. But he said that default changed when we started communicating digitally. With the default is everything is recorded. And that changed the way that people have human interactions. You know, when you're in high school, like it's a time of high drama. People have fights all the time. And so if, you know, you and your best friend like get into some dispute, it's like, fuck you. No, fuck you. I never want to see you again. Fine with me. You know, and you have that fight. If you have that fight in person, the next time you see each other, you could both pretend that it never happened and go back to normal. And that's what people do all the time. But if you have that other text chain, the next time you open that thread with your friend, you're looking at this last exchange, which says, fuck you. No, fuck you. I never want to see you again. It's much harder to just pretend that never happened. And he said, like, what he was doing was restoring the default in digital communications as well as in the real world. And this was an important point. He said, there is no digital world and real world. There is just the world. And the world should work the same. When you communicate with your friends, that should be history. It should disappear. It wasn't about ephemeral communication. It was about restoring the defaults. No one chose the defaults in digital communication that everything is recorded. Like that was not a deliberate design decision by anybody. And he's, in his view, which has turned out to be correct, it was an error, which he's since fixed. And that's why we got disappearing messages.
So clearly at this point, I mean, Snapchat is growing exceptionally well. They've got product market fit in terms of usage, but they're also not making any revenue. And they're about to face a massive competitive threat. Because as we all know, you know, Facebook tried to kind of buy Snapchat at one point. And after Evan decided not to sell in late 2012, Facebook launches this copycat app called Poke. And it quickly, I mean, they have billion users at this point. So it quickly goes to the top of the charts. And it's a bit of a existential moment for Snapchat. But it turns out all that that did was actually make Snapchat more popular because every single article talked about how Poke was a copycat of Snapchat. And so it just created all this publicity for Snapchat. And frankly, the audience that Facebook went after, either they were already kind of using Snapchat or their friends were using Snapchat. And so they weren't willing to like move to another platform, or they were much older, in which case they just didn't care about the disappearing nature of it. So it turns out that actually was a tailwind for Snapchat in the long run. But even still, there's so many consumer apps that get to a certain point and then kind of crater off. I don't know if you remember like the Yo app. That was really cool until it wasn't. Clubhouse lately became a unicorn and then just kind of exploded and went away. So what I asked Jeremy Liu is, why did Snapchat not just take off, but continue to stay relevant when so many other consumer apps don't?
When we invest, I think there's four things we look for in a consumer app. Can this become part of pop culture? And you know, one of the early indicators for that is that it's primarily used by young women, because I think young women are culture carriers. You kind of think about a bunch of guys get together, you know, they'll go play basketball, they'll play, you know, a video game or something, because then they don't have to talk to each other. You don't have to have a meaningful conversation with your guy friends when you're doing an activity. You can just talk about the activity. pick up your man. You suck. You know, shoot again. All that. Like, so you can avoid having any meaningful conversation whatsoever with your friends. When women get together, and this is obviously a massive generalization, but like, I think there's a germ of truth to it. Women get together, they choose an activity as an excuse to talk to each other. Whereas men choose an activity as an excuse to not talk to each other. Women go to a book club, 10% of the conversation is about the book, 90% of the conversation about what's going on with your life. That's why women are carriers of pop culture, because they talk to each other. Men don't. So obviously that propagation is going to happen when there are real conversations happening. Like this thing you just tried, or this, you know, whatever it is. So, and what we saw with Snap was a heavy concentration in young women, which is a pretty good indicator that it could become part of pop culture over time. So that's the first thing we saw. Second thing we look for is it creating new habits? And with the DAU over MAU ratio and the D30 retention, it was very clear this was creating new habits. And that's one of the interesting things about, you know, the difference between social media and messaging. With social media, there is no expectation that you respond. You can look at it and do nothing, totally fine. Your friend isn't like, oh, dude, like, why did you, you know, why didn't you heart it? Why didn't you like, no comment? Like, what's going on? If you send someone a message, there's an expectation of response. If you don't respond, you're the asshole. Don't leave me on unread. That was creating this habit, this ping pong, which later got institutionalized as streaks, that was creating habituation. The third thing that we look for is a scalable, repeatable way to grow. And with Snapchat, firstly, the data showed that it was obviously happening, right? 50% month-to-month growth, like something's going on. What's really important in all of this is that the founder needs to have a unique insight that's explaining what is going on. And so he was able to do that in this really clear way that I think we all now, it's common knowledge. Like, but at that time, no one was talking about this. No one was talking about how historically human communication was ephemeral. No one was talking about performance anxiety in social media. No one was talking about the fact that, you know, when you were posting on social media, you were just posting the highlight reels of your life. When you're happy, when you're proud, when you're excited, when you're doing something new and novel and fun and interesting. And Evan's perspective was, if you want to make real lasting friendships, you can't only be sharing the top 10% of your life. You've got to see the full 100% of your life. When you're happy and excited and proud and nervous and anxious and sad and angry and all of the emotions that you have. And that wasn't happening on social media, but it had a place on Snap. And that was creating stronger relationships. And that was what was driving this organic viral growth. Not viral because people were sending out invites, because historically, like the way people measure virality is like, you know, how many invites did you send? What's the response rate? You know, is K greater than one? But viral in the sense that people were talking about it to each other. You know, you'd see someone get a message, open their phone, laugh, and then put their phone away and be like, what was it? What'd you see? What's so funny? Like, why are you laughing? You know, your friend be like, oh, I can't show you. It's disappeared. It's like, what do you mean it's disappeared? Oh, well, it's this new app, Snap. I use it with my good friends. Like, well, tell me more. Like, how can I get on it? Like, you know, and then the only way you could get on at that time, you remember there was no like digital invitation process. Like in the beginning, the only way you could be added is for someone to give you their username. So that people were like telling someone about the app. They download it. They'd have to give you the username to get connected. And then the first thing they would do was they would send them a snap of themselves making a funny face or something. And then like the user culture grew because the propagation of new users wasn't through some blast invitation. Like you show up and you try to figure out how to use it. It happened because a person who used it, who knew how to use it properly, whatever that means, but like that culture of how to use Snap in the beginning, would send you a funny picture or a random picture or a picture of just what they were looking at. And you started to understand through the process of actually receiving snaps, how to send a snap. What's a good snap? What are you supposed to do here? That was incredibly powerful.
Now by 2013, Snapchat has about 50 million daily active users. They raise a Series A from Benchmark. They keep growing. Just later that year, raise a Series B. They have an acquisition offer for $3 billion from Facebook, which they turned down. And for many, many years, they keep growing at a pretty crazy rate. By 2015, they cross 100 million daily active users. By 2018, they cross 200 million daily active users. And like I said, now they have 400 million daily active users. And in many cases, in the younger demographic, they've got like 90% penetration. The other thing I wanted to understand was, what was so special about Evan? Like, what did Evan get right? What did he do right that led to the Snapchat that we know today?
So I think that product has always been the magical superpower for Snap, and it has come from this unique insight, this understanding of the user base. I think there are plenty of people who are great at product who will take current best practices and iterate on that. And what Heaven had this superpower was his ability to not just look at current best practices and think, okay, how can I make that better? But he would question the basic premises and come up with something that was entirely novel. And the, you know, ephemeral messaging was a good example of that. When you said, okay, well, like, you know, historically, have we recorded our communications? No, we haven't. Okay, we shouldn't. Another thing that he did was when he came up with stories, historically, social media had always been reverse chronological order. The most recent thing was on the top of the feed. He explained it to me. How do you tell stories? Beginning, middle, end. How does social media tell stories? End, middle, beginning. Well, that makes no sense. We are going to tell stories in chronological order, and they're going to disappear because that is part of what's so important about, you know, Snap. We're going to tell stories beginning, middle, end. Now everybody does that. Now it's like obvious. It's the new best practice. It was a complete innovation at that time. And it's just one of a bunch of examples of how Evan and his product insight, his understanding of the consumer, has led to building a product that started at 50% DMAU and then went to 60 and 70, and it just keeps on going up because he understands the user. So it's not about like a clever growth hack. It's about understanding the user and what they want.
So maybe just as a final question, you know, obviously you've seen the growth of Snap and you've seen many other consumer apps. From the perspective of, let's say, you know, there's a founder of a consumer app, they're getting some growth and they want to get a sense of like, do they have real product market fit? You know, as you think through that question, what are some of the top things that you look for?
I'd say it's those four questions that I led with at the beginning. You know, could this become part of pop culture? And a subset of that is, you know, what's the demographics of the power users? If they skew young and female, that's definitely a good indicator. If you think about a lot of, it's not just Snap, Instagram, Facebook, MySpace, they all started with the young female users. Pinterest, maybe older female users. I think Reddit's really the only big social media example that started with a primarily male audience, right? Which doesn't mean, I'm not suggesting that, like, I mean, obviously Reddit exists, it can happen. But if you look at the preponderance of the data,
pattern, yeah.
There is a pattern that says young female users is very positive for that. So like, could it become part of pop culture? Is it building new habits? Is there a scalable, repeatable way to grow? By the way, that doesn't have to be real world virality. That's the best form, but it doesn't have to be that. You can do manufactured virality. You can do invitations. Many people do. You can do paid marketing. Is it scalable and repeatable? And then finally, like, does the founder have a unique insight that explains it all? But both parts of that are important. Is it an insight, right? Is this something that's really like explains what's going on? And is it unique? You know, like to say, oh, well, this is working because like everybody has a mobile phone now. Like, that's not a unique insight. But what Evan came up with was a unique insight.
We'll stop it there. Thank you very much for taking the time. That was those are some great, great anecdotes. And I think will really help founders understand how Snapchat happened, but I think more generally what it takes to build one of these kind of N of one companies.
Terrific. Good. Glad to be able to help.
If you listen to this episode and the show and you like it, I have a huge favor to ask for you. Well, it's actually a really small favor, but it has huge impact. But whichever app you're listening to this episode on, take it out, go to Product Market Fit Show and leave a review, please. It's going to help. It's not just going to help me, to be clear. It's going to help other founders discover the show because the algorithms, whether it's Spotify, whether it's Apple, whether it's any other podcast player, one of the big things they look at is frequency of reviews. It's quantity of reviews. And the reality is if all of you listening right now left reviews, we would have thousands of reviews. So please take literally a minute, even if you're just writing like great podcast or I love this podcast, whatever it is, just write a few words. Obviously, the longer the better, the more detailed the better, but write anything, leave 5 stars and you will be helping me, but most importantly, many other founders just like you discover the show. Thank you.